This is the sixth day of this July 2010 seven-day session. And we'll resume commenting on our koan from yesterday. This is the second koan in the Mumonkan, Baijang and a Fox, Baijang or Hyakujo, to use his Japanese name. Just a little review of what we covered yesterday. It was too much to do it in, there's too much material in this koan to do it all in one teisho. But the case for this koan is about a man who says that he may look like a man, but he is actually a fox. He consigned himself to 500 years, 500 lives as a fox, because as the former abbot of the monastery there, he had answered a question wrongly. The question is, can an enlightened person fall under the chain of cause and effect or not? And he had said, eons ago, when he was the abbot, he had said he does not fall under the chain of cause and effect. Looking for the exact words. All right, that's good enough. He said no, he doesn't. And now he's standing before Baijang, the great Baijang, and asking if he would give him the right answer. And Baijang says he does not ignore the law of causation. Now, we pointed out yesterday that to be enlightened does not mean you escape the laws of science and biology and are immune to causation. I talked about how just it's so obvious on a physical level that Bodhidharma is once said to have reminded us, anyone who has a body is an heir to suffering and a stranger to peace. And I spent some time extending this into one's emotional life. The emotional and the physical are very, you can't tease them apart. And so the enlightened woman or man also has emotions and feelings and is vulnerable to human reactions from past karma, past conditioning. The conditioning is not just obliterated through an enlightenment experience. Even it seems, even full enlightenment. So why is it, and I know this myself from the past, why is it that we want to envision a world of enlightenment as one where we can escape the law of causation, that we are somehow superhuman and we have no vulnerabilities and I think it might relate to our religious conditioning in Christianity, maybe the other Abrahamic religions, there is this notion of a heaven where you can go and you leave the earth and the dictates and the mandates of earthly, worldly limitations, and you ascend into heaven. It's always up into the sky. And if you can accept the common conventions of cartoonists, you float around, you walk around on clouds and in long white robes, and you can have anything you want and just live a life of eternal peace and bliss. These images, I'm speaking lightly about the cartoons, but these images seep into our minds. They become our conditioning. Paradise is a human longing, and we see it in all of the world's cultures, this vision of paradise, freedom. And we bring that with us to practice, and we project it onto the enlightenment experience. In Buddhism, it's not just notions of paradise or heaven, but emptiness. We concoct a realm of emptiness that is apart from form, and that is a fatal mistake. There is no way we can escape our bodies if we mean by that being somehow superhuman. One of the better known statements in Japanese Zen was by Zen master Keizan, who was the spiritual grandson of Dogen, Keizan Zenji. And in this statement, he says the following: though you find clear waters ranging to the vast blue sky of autumn, how can that compare with the hazy moon of a summer night? Most want it pure white, but sweep as you will, the mind will never be empty. And we need to understand what this means, because it relates very much to this koan. As human beings with human mind bodies, we will always have thoughts arising in the mind. And in the koan, we will not deny or ignore or evade the law of causation. But this is not to say that we are just doomed to have the mind always to be oppressed in the mind by our thoughts. Well, we know this. Anyone by now, the sixth day of Sesshin, everyone has some sense of getting above the clouds of thought, and that's what we find through our own experience. So we have these two extremes that are invalid. One is that the enlightened person just has to labor like everyone else under this oppressive chain of causation. And the other is, that's one. The other is that he or she is utterly free. And this is the horns of the dilemma that this koan is embedded on. We can't say, yes, the enlightened man is free of the chain of cause and effect, and to say no is also not the full truth. So how does the enlightened person be free in some sense, some kind of freedom? Or how is the enlightened person able to not be captive by the law of causation? Well, we get a little pointer from the Hakuin chant that we recite before each Teisho, we did just a few minutes ago. In there he says, one true samadhi extinguishes evils. It purifies karma, dissolving obstructions. We talked yesterday about how in Sesshin we are reaping the effects of our misuse of our minds and our bodies through most of the year, through most of our life, through most of our lives. We have been misdirecting our attention, scattering our minds, undisciplined in our conduct and in the way we carry ourselves, the way we sit, the way we eat, the way we respond to others. At the same time, Sesshin is an opportunity to develop freedom from that same karma. We have this marvelous tool of the human mind where we can face our pain, emotional, mental, as well as physical, our confusion, and by not separating ourselves from it, by merging completely with this one practice that we're working on, we are not just expiating karma, we are changing our way of responding to circumstances and conditions in the larger world, not just in Sesshin. So Sesshin is but we encounter both our so-called bad karma, our obstructive karma in Sesshin, but we also, because of this opportunity it gives us, it's wonderful karma to be in Sesshin. Tremendous. I can't think of any better opportunity to change our karma than through Sesshin. Tremendous privilege. Karma, the law of causation, should never be confused with fate. Fate I looked this up just to be clear about it. Fate is a force or a power or a principle that predetermines events. Or it also can be understood as the inevitable events predestined by that force. And that would be a complete misunderstanding of causation. Causation is not just whatever we have reaped we have to sow. No. That's not karma. That is not causation. Because we are bringing our own response to the whole formula, the picture. It's a dynamic process. The way we meet our past karma, we are changing it continually. We're not condemned to just suffer under this chain of what we have sown in the past. Our experience is determined. Our experience of this past karma is determined by, again, how we use or misuse our minds, our attention. How can we be free from birth and death? The gateway to freedom is Zazen Samadhi. For those working on Mu, the gateway to freedom is Mu. Oneness with Mu. For those working on the breath, the gateway to freedom is oneness with the breath. And so forth. Whatever one's practice is. Beyond exaltation, beyond all our praises, the pure Mahayana. So with these turning words by the master Baijiang, the old man immediately awakened. He made his bows and said, "I am now released from rebirth as a fox, and my body will be found on the other side of this mountain. I wish to make a request of you. Please bury me as a dead monk." This in the monastic tradition, this would be very important to receive the rites and the rituals of a monk. A fox, Roshi Kapler used to say, a fox has this dual nature in Zen. It can be seen sort of as we see it in the West as a tricky, devious, but it can also be seen as something quite free, in a kind of a wild, wonderful way. So Baijiang had the head monks strike the clappers and told the monks that after lunch there would be a funeral service for a dead monk. The monks all were puzzled because they didn't know of anyone in the infirmary. It's called the Nirvana Hall. And they wondered what was going on. So after lunch, Baijiang gathered them up, led them to the foot of a rock on the far side of the mountain. It must have been quite a hike to get there. And then with his staff, he poked out the dead body of a fox and had it cremated. I'm thinking Baijiang had set this all up ahead of time. Either he or one of his senior monks had in the walking in the wild there, had come across this body of a dead fox and reported it to Bai Zhang, and Bai Zhang came up with this theater to dramatize this matter of enlightenment and delusion, causation, karma, and so forth. In the evening, Bai Zhang took his seat in the hall and told the monks the whole story. And then his most famous disciple, Huang Bo, Obaku in Japanese, Huang Bo asked the following question. Now this Huang Bo at the time was already a deeply enlightened senior monk. And this is the question he came up with. This old man made a mistake in his answer and suffered rebirth as a fox for 500 lives, you say. But now, suppose every time he had answered, he had not made a mistake. What would he have become then? Watch out for the trap, Bai Zhang. Bai Zhang says, just come closer to me and I'll tell you. Huang Bo then went up to Bai Zhang and slapped him. Bai Zhang, clapping his hands and laughing, exclaimed, I thought that only the barbarian's beard is red, but I see that you are a barbarian with a red beard. This is another point of the koan, secondary one. The primary point to be demonstrated in Doksan is one's understanding of that line, he does not ignore the law of causation. And it cannot be explained in Doksan. It has to be physically demonstrated. This is the whole point of koans, is to embody what we understand. Everyone who comes to Sesshin, maybe everyone who comes to practice, has some glimmer of understanding about the nature of the Dharma, of this non-dual reality that we call the Dharma. But to actually physically demonstrate it is something that takes a different level of comprehension, of understanding. It means body understanding. There are lots of things in this world that we can understand in our minds, in our heads, but it's another thing to live it. I do have some material on this Huang Bo. Died in the year 850, when he was young he entered a monastery on Mount Huangbo. A lot of these masters' names came from the mountain where they lived. say that Wang Bo's physical appearance was striking. He had a large, protruding forehead that was whimsically described as a large pearl. He's probably used to approaching people, and as he did, Bai Zhang, looming over them. He was regarded as a teacher with simple methods and few words. Once his teacher, Bai Zhang, asked him, "Where have you been?" Huang Bo said, "I've been picking mushrooms at the base of the mountain." Bai Zhang said, "Did you see a big tiger?" Huang Bo roared. Bai Zhang picked up an axe and assumed a pose as if to strike Huang Bo. Huang Bo then hit him. Bai Zhang laughed and returned to his room. Later, Bai Zhang entered the hall and said to the monks, "At the base of the mountain there's a tiger. You monks should go take a look at it. Just today, I myself suffered a bite from it." There's a very famous story of a time when he was doing prostrations before the altar, and the future emperor was serving as a novice monk in the temple. Can you imagine a young heir to the throne coming to the temple? And the future emperor asked Wang Bo, "Not seeking Buddha, not seeking Dharma, not seeking Sangha. When the master bows, what is it you're seeking?" So he has gotten this idea of non-seeking from his Buddhist little education, and he's challenging the master. Only a young emperor would probably do such a thing. And Wang Bo said, "Not seeking Buddha, not seeking Dharma, not seeking Sangha. One always bows in just this manner." And the young emperor said, "Then why bow?" To which Wang Bo hit him. The young emperor said, "You're really too crude." Wang Bo said, "What place is this we're in? Is it for idle chatter?" And then he hit the novice again. He hit the emperor again. This is, I think, widely quoted, this exchange as a way of letting students know that if they have trouble with prostrations and bowing and other devotional practices in Zen, they're not the first. There are many of us, when we come to practice, we want the Zen without the rituals, without the devotional part of it. But it's always, the devotional part has always been part of Zen Buddhism. These great masters, why would Huang Bo, deeply enlightened master, and all the others do these prostrations if they didn't feel there was something very valuable about doing them? Six new students came to greet Zen Master Huang Bo. Five of the students bowed, but the other student lifted his meditation cushion and drew a circle in the air with it. Huang Bo said, I've heard that it's evil to keep a hunting dog. I don't get that, but let's just roll with it here. The monk said, I'm chasing the sound of the wild sheep. Huangbo said, the sheep makes no sound for you to chase. The monk said, then I'll pursue the sheep by seeing its traces. Huangbo said, there are no traces for you to pursue. Of course, they're talking here about mind. The monk said, then I will track it. Huangbo said, there are no tracks for you to follow. The monk said, if that's the case, then the sheep is dead. The next day, Huangbo addressed the monk, saying, I want the monk who was looking for the wild sheep yesterday to come forward. The monk came forward. Huangbo said, the public case we discussed yesterday is not finished. After we finished speaking, what did you think? The monk remained silent. Huangbo said, at first I thought you were a monk of the true teaching, but actually you're a debating instructor. And then he chased the monk out of the hall. So way back now in the ninth century, as is the case now and has ever been so, there are those who are clever enough to come back with some quick repartee in debate or exchanges. It's not the same as having really understood this matter beyond all dualisms, beyond all dichotomies. All right, that's all just to give a little sketch of character of Huangbo. Now we'll turn to the commentary. Mumon says, not falling under the law of cause and effect. Why was he turned into a fox? Not ignoring the law of causation. Why was he released from a fox body? If in regard to this you have the one eye to see into this, you will know that the former head of the monastery did enjoy his 500 lives as a fox. I'm thinking of Murphy the dog that we heard about last night in the Zendo. The great advantage that animals have over us is they don't separate themselves from the conditions and the circumstances of their lives. They don't have this frontal cortex that gives them the self-consciousness that we human beings have. And so they are naturally one with the circumstances and conditions of their lives. But it's not a good bargain all in all, because they don't have the capacity, having never been estranged, have any sense of self-consciousness, they don't have the capacity, so it would seem, they don't have the capacity to be reunited with this true nature, to experience, to come to self-realization. They are too bound by their conditions, too bound to the body. We have the ability to think and to reflect on our existence, our limitations as human beings. And this is the great promise of being born into a human body, being able to come to awakening. We really say he enjoyed his 500 lives as a fox? Do foxes enjoy their lives? Ask a fox. See what the fox says. And now the verse, Mumon's verse. Not falling, not ignoring. Two faces, but one die. Not ignoring, not falling. Hundreds and thousands of regrets. Here, Mumon, Wumen, is wrapping things up and asking us to take one final closer look at what's going on here. Not falling, not ignoring, two faces, but one die. Die, meaning like a single part of a pair of dice that we throw in games. Two faces, but one die. To say that we are bound by the law of causation is only half the truth, and as such, it's not true, because it's not the whole truth. It's just looking at reality from one side. Yes, we are bound in the sense that, as we said yesterday, when we're cut, we bleed. And there are many other millions of ways that we exist according to natural causes and natural laws of science and so forth. This is the conventional or the worldly view, but it's not the whole one. Neither is it, can we say, that we can escape it completely in a literal sense. This is falling into attachment to emptiness, the other side. These are the two sides, form and emptiness, the relative and the absolute. And it's only because we concoct these words, these concepts, that they're two. In reality, beyond words and concepts, these are not two. This world of form and the world of emptiness. There's a story about karma that I ran across that involved the Buddha. This is from a book, Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart, Parables of the Spiritual Path from Around the World. And according to this, the Buddha, in his peregrinations around northern India, he encountered a member of the Jain faith. Jain is somewhat like Buddhism, somewhat related, but much more extreme in some ways. And this Jain was, his practice consisted of standing still on one leg. Now, for those of you who haven't heard of this, it's a preposterous sounding practice. And in fact, it's probably a preposterous practice. but it's the kind of thing that religion can cause people to do. Let's just continue reading. The Buddha asks him, would you tell me why you are doing this? What will this practice of standing on one leg do for you? The Jain replied, through this practice I am working out my karma. It will free me of all past karma. The Buddha asked him, how much have you worked out so far? The Jain replied, I could not say. The Buddha then asked, how much karma do you still have left to work out? The Jain again replied, I do not know. At last the Buddha asked him, but will you know when you have finished working out your karma? The Jain could only answer again, this I do not know. At this reply, the Buddha spoke to him, saying, it is time for you to set aside this practice and to understand the path to the end of suffering. It lies within the truth of each moment, here and now. Couldn't help with a story, think of what Nietzsche once said about the truth. We were just talking about the two sides of reality, the two perspectives. We can look at it one way, we can look at it from the other way. Nietzsche said, it is good to express a matter in two ways simultaneously so as to give it both a right foot and a left foot. Truth can stand on one leg, to be sure, but with two, it can walk and get about. As we said yesterday, it's a great, great danger in Buddhism and Zen especially. I think Zen is especially susceptible to the danger of getting attached to emptiness, to thinking that the law of causation is something that we can dismiss, we can ignore it, we can deny it, and this is very often the root problem behind the misconduct of teachers and others who think that they're above it somehow. It's a very grave, grave misunderstanding. Bodhidharma himself, the founder of our school, once said, one who thinks only that everything is void, but is ignorant of the law of causation, falls into everlasting pitch black hell. It can be tempting to believe, to get caught up in emptiness, because in fact one sees through awakening that the law of causation is ultimately empty. It is. But as we say in the Prajnaparamita, emptiness is no other than form. These two are inseparable, but you cannot tease them apart. Human laws of and cause and effect. Not ignoring, not falling, hundreds and thousands of regrets. This is another point of the koan, and not an easy one. Well, it seems that our karma now, our causes and conditions are such that our time has run out, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.